I'm going to get high. I'm going to get very high. This is Higher Ground, WEFT, Champaign 90.1 FM. And I am Eunice Buckner Boone, and it's my turn for Higher Ground.
Higher ground, we got to find us a better way of living up.
Well, that was nice introduction. Higher Ground, which is where the name of this radio program was, I guess, Higher Ground. Yeah, Higher Ground, Stevie Wonder, Higher Ground. It was a talk show, Chicago, Leon Sanders, Higher Ground, Higher Ground. That is how this name was originated over 20 years ago, Higher Ground. So that was Doug Carn and his Higher Ground. Doug Carn and Gene Carn. That was nice. Nice, nice, nice. All right, so this is my turn this Saturday, and I'm always thankful to be here. Eunice is thankful to be here. It's been over, it's been a long time. It may have been 22, 23. I think I started somewhere around 92, 94 here, the station. The Jeff Machota posted something on WEFTO. He's been there 25 years doing a jazz show. It's probably quite a few people, several people here. I know Greg Harris, Sunday mornings. He's been on here maybe since the beginning of WEF Community Radio. I saw that Renee Angela does a Thursday morning menu. She's leaving. It's a lot of people. She's not been here that long, but as long as 20-something years, but, you know, people come and go. People come back. WEF continues to thrive. That's how community is. It thrives, it changes, and is supported by the members. So, hey, it's great to be here. The views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, Champaign, Prairie Air, Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. It's good to know, right? Mm-hmm. So what does Eunice have in store for you today? Well, I hope you will enjoy it as much as I'm going to enjoy it. I have a guest. She's calling in, though. However, she was here in town on Thursday. There's a art showing at the University YMCA on Wright Street. And it began its with a reception on Thursday at 5 o'clock. And you would actually hear the speaker and the artist, Candace Hunter. She presented her current series, Hooded Truths, a cornucopia of images and ideas and personas, all swathed in the costume of 21st century America, the hoodie. Hunter explores the history of blackness in this country, a history that Hunter describes as a painful and complicated affair, brightened by the indomitable spirit of countless fathers, mothers, teachers, clergy, and artists who continue to shed light on this country's hooded truths. Much of the work of Candace Hunter is concerned with social inequality along both national and global fronts. Her imagery explores historical moments that celebrate the beauty of a people and sheds necessary light upon violence. Against humanity, with special attention to the plight of women and children. So the Hooded Truths exhibit will be at the YMCA on campus through October 7th, 2016. So Candace will be on the air with me via telephone. She will call in at 359-5483. That's our call-in line, 359-5483, and I will answer the phone at 8:30, and we will begin our conversation, and this conversation will last until the conclusion of my Higher Ground today, which will be 10 o'clock, because her artwork, it's also performance artwork. It's also words. It's verbal. It's she fully engages you on every level of her of being a human being. She has the art displays. She has this standing piece of art in which you can, it's shaped like a hoodie, but you can put your head in it. I was smiling when I put my head in and not thinking what the symbolism of the art. I was just really being light and not even really thinking about it as a photo moment. But one of the most poignant ones for me was the lens in which she made the hollow hood, the hood hollowed out like a lens. And so this, what's going on in our country, what has been going on for many, many years in terms of life and specifically black life and the young men and also women that have been killed that has not gotten as much media attention. The lens in which we are beginning to have to look at ourselves and not have to, but need to look. And not blame, but look at, honestly, look at what's showing up. Because if you don't look at what's showing up, then it still remains the same. And you can't just point at one thing. You have to look at what is going on and be solution oriented. And so that lens is very honest. And Candace engages you on a very honest, direct, simplistic level. So that you get it. There's no way to avoid her conversing the way she speaks to the audience and her direct way in which she looks directly at a particular audience member and speaks to what is not just art entertainment, but how art is used in order to bring light, to provoke, and to motivate deeper inner introspection and to bring about a genuine change in the self, in the way one understands and perceives itself. It's for everybody. So if you look up her name, Candace Hunter, on the internet, you will also find that she has an extensive array of art presentations that she presents in a serial form. It's more than one piece, and it's done perhaps performance and also, what is it, performance as well as written word, as well as, I forgot what the other one was, presentation, something about how you put it together. But she's had many different showings and gotten awards for her work, and she declared herself a professional artist in 2007. But she's been doing art all of her life. So anyway, you will enjoy the conversation, and it will take at least that long for her to discuss the historical, political, social context in which why she does the type of art she does. Predominantly, the medium of choice is collage. But it is absolutely intriguing to watch, to look at her many different art pieces on the internet. So just explore that. And that's coming up in 15 minutes. Well, not quite 15 minutes. So I'm telling you, I always have so much planned for you. And yet there isn't enough. I just want to make sure that you're definitely full. So let me do these announcements before it's time. Okay, here. what's happening on Friday through September 1st? Friday, August 26th through September 1st. Playing daily is Indignation at the Art Theater, a movie based on Philip Roth's novel that tells the story of a working class Jewish boy and his growing infatuation with his non-Jewish girlfriend, causing problems both in school and on the home front. Al Pacino plays a bank robber attempting to get enough money for his lover's sex change surgery is told in a critically acclaimed movie, Dog Day Afternoon. It will have four screenings, plus for some background on the actual events that the movie is based upon, you can listen to Connie's Hot Flashes on the movies this week. So for all current dates and times, you can go to www.arttheater.coop/full schedule. Okay, what else we got here? Let's see what else is here. Labor of Love, Nightjar Promotions, a full day of art and music to benefit the IMC kickoff of the WEF Fall Pledge Drive. Labor of Love, September 3rd, 2016, 1 p.m. through 11 p.m. at the Independent Media Center, 202 South Broadway in Urbana. So yes, reminder, coming up is a fundraiser for our Fall Pledge fundraiser month. So yes. Get ready to continue to support WEF as you always have been. And we thank you very much because we are all here as volunteers. Well, there's a few paid persons, but mostly we're all volunteers. I just want to say thank you to our National Park Service because this is their 100th birthday of the National Park Service. And there were events all across the United States on Thursday. And I just want to say this because we have some wonderful parks here in Champaign-Urbana. I walk pretty frequently in the Meadowbrook Park, which is near where I currently live. But I think that the National Park Service, which is a separate entity of its own, has done a tremendous, tremendous job keeping us spiritually connected and grounded in our relationship to the earth and to one another and to... It's such a great place to go to parks, to decompress, to relax, to enjoy, and to just be. So I just have to say that for that. And also, one more thing I'd like to talk about. This is not local. However, it is the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture will have its... grand opening on September 24, 2016. And that has been a long time effort spearheaded too by Representative John Lewis, who began in 1988 to introduce to Congress authorizing an act to have such a museum. And the Smithsonian broke ground in 2012 and with matching funds was able to build this first African-American History and Culture Museum, Smithsonian National Museum of African-American History and Culture. And so it's going to be a really big grand opening event, and that will take place on September 24, 2016 in Washington. So there's more information about that if you want to look that up. And of course, as they say, there's the usual suspects. And what are the usual suspects in Casablancas? We're going to round up the usual suspects. Well, there continues to be, of course, elections will be coming up soon. And so the, you know, discussions about politics related to the two candidates who are running for office. But specifically, I like to talk about David Gill, who is... a local candidate is running for office for the fourth time. I think it's the fourth time. But he's running this time as an independent. And he had to petition the court in order for him to be on the ballot. And the reason why I want to highlight this particular fact is because independents are required to, some extraneous kind of reason, come up with more signatures, like three times, four times, five times as many. And the 90 days, they have to come up with that. And so he said, okay, did it. And then some of the signatures was challenged for his petition. However, he said it's not right that independents who declare themselves independent candidates have to do more, way more than, say, a Democrat or Republican candidate. So it was decided that he will definitely have his name on the ballot, so he will be running. And I just really appreciate that, because David Gill, you're not a quitter. You're just not a quitter. You look at a problem and you say, wait, I'm not going to focus on the problem. I'm going to focus on how to solve it. And I think that is a very powerful thing to do. Once you realize that discouragement is not meant to discourage you, it's meant to encourage you to strengthen that which is weak and that which is needs to be strengthened. And to know and to act on what you do not know by being open to the knowing. So you know something now, but you don't get stuck in the knowing what you know now. It's the node. Now you are including this knowing. And that points to our unlimited potential. And we've seen that, not at the Olympics only, but we've seen it on Facebook with videos, etc. People who have done astounding things, and they weren't necessarily trying to win a award, or they weren't competing, but they were demonstrating and showing that even if there are some weakened areas in their what it perceives to be, they move beyond that. And I think we can be encouraged by that. We can be encouraged by the David Gill spirit of, I'm not going to quit. David Gill believes that he can do some good for the government. For the government that's supposed to govern the people. And he believes that running as an independent candidate, he will be able to do that, since he was not elected as a Democratic candidate. But I like the spirit, and that's what I'm speaking to. So if I sound like if I'm endorsing him, perhaps maybe I am. I believe in people who want to serve and really do serve, as opposed to serving themselves. And those who challenge the system in a way that is respectful, but indeed a protest that needs to be made and attention given to, without shrinking back and saying, oh, it's going to always be this way, and what can I do to change it? Did you know that Bruce Lee, the karate, well, I don't know if he was karate person, but, you know, martial arts, that he had weaknesses? But if you look at him, you wouldn't think he did have any weakness. But I heard that he had one foot was shorter than the other, and that he was nearsighted. But who would know, because he learned how to accommodate those particular, what one would consider a weakness, and turn it into a strength. So he created his own way of doing things. And I think it's so important that we pay attention. One of the things that Candace Hunter, the artist, when I went to a reception, spoke to, is that when African men, women, and children, over 12 million, were taken from Africa, that they were also taken away from their culture, but from the food, the lifestyle, the way they ate. And I played for you the last time I was on Higher Ground, Dr. Serby, who also mentioned that the food that was the type that we ate, that the Africans ate, they were not eating that anymore. So that's going to have a impact physically on how your cells flourish, or they grow, or they're nourished. So it's really important that we pay attention, and also that we continue to claim the fact that we are all here, and that, you know, not every effort to be a human being, it happens that there are many efforts put out there before an infant, a baby, is beginning to form. So there are many don't. So the ones that do, it's not saying they're better than, it's just that over time, these many are going to be, and then there's going to always be life. But when you think of yourself as you were the one that made it. You were the one that went through the full cycle. So Don't ever think of yourself as less. Never, ever. It's the most sufferable thing that we have ever done when we do that, and we do that to other people, to other persons. So anyway, I have an announcement to do. I need to get that on the board here because I'm getting closer to, no, is it 8:30? Well, I'm looking at this on up here, and it just looks like it says it is, but I've got these things to do first, and I need to turn on the telephone line because I didn't turn that on either, but it's on now. Everything is on. So give me a minute. I'm going to play some music. So Candace, I hope she calls me at 8:35 because somewhere we've got some different times going in here. My underwriting announcement, Elliott Counseling Group has 35 counselors providing mental health services for individuals, families, couples, children, and groups. Evening and weekend appointments are often available immediately. Virtually all insurance, including state employee insurance, is accepted. There is also a self-pay sliding scale. You can contact Kevin Elliott or his staff at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. This is E-L-L-I-O-T-T, CounselingGroup.com, or 217-398-9066. So I'm going to play some music, and I'm going to play Andra Day. Andra Day, I think she is fabulous. And get ready for Candace's call in just a minute. So I'm trying to think. I'm going to play this one, Forever Mine. Yeah, that one I'm going to play. And I'll be back with you very shortly. You was cooking up a no-stop. How did you like that? Oh, I just really like her sound. It's very throaty, and she's compared to Amy Winehouse, Eartha Kitt. I'm trying to think who's the other ones they compared her to. But I just found her one day scrolling through TV, and there she is. And then I forgot what her name was. I had to find it. And there is one song she does that is so cool. I think it's called, is that called Cheers to the Fall or Only Love? No, not that one. I think it's Cheers to the Fall. But they liken that to a James Bond movie, sound. What is it called? A James Bond song. It is just wonderful. But anyway, so I'm still waiting for Candace to call. 359-5483. I've sent her a text. So I'm going to talk a little more, and I'll keep looking for the phone to. It's not offline. Everything is working. It's to talk a little bit about what I've heard at the Candace talk on Thursday. It's interesting. Maybe I need to do something else. I want to make sure that we've got Candace. I'm going to put some more music on. For some reason, I'm not getting any response. So let's see here. I want to make sure. I'm going to play Rise Up. That's a good one, too. You're probably familiar with this one, but I may only be able to play just a part of it. So I'm going to start. No, I'm not going to do that. Not with my cell phone. I'm going to do this. Which one are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to find it on my YouTube. What am I looking for? Higher Ground. No, more can't, more Andre. Andre. It's Andre. A-N-R-A. No. A-N-D-R-A. Day. There we go. Technology at your hands. All right. Hopefully there's no commercial. Yep, there's a commercial there. So I'm going to have to wait for the part where it says skip commercial. Okay, skip. There we go. All right, it's coming. Hello, Candace? Hello? Let's try this again. Okay. Something is not working. Let's try one more time. Call again. Just having a little technical difficulty, right? I'll put some music on. And I know you feel like something is not working.
Ooh, I won't take, bring it to his feet. That we have each other.
Hello, Candace?
Yes.
Okay, I'll have to try it.
Hello?
This is frustrating.
Good morning.
Hello?
Hello, good morning.
I'm going to need some help here.
Hello?
Everything is on. Volume is up. Okay. Get this phone not on.
You're broken down and tired of living life.
What we're gonna do here is I'm just gonna have her, I'm just gonna call her on my phone because I'm not able to do this here.
So we're gonna walk it out.
For some reason, it's not working.
Long days. We gon' walk it out and move. Long days. And I'll rise up. I'll rise like the day. I'll rise up.
Okay. All right, Candace, what I'm going to have to do is we're just going to have to talk through my cell phone, because I'm not quite sure why I'm not able to pull you up on the line here. I hope you don't mind. Okay, good. Good morning, Candace. How are you doing? Thank you so much. You are one powerful woman. You know that, don't you?
And it feels
like it's getting hard to breathe.
If I say so.
And I know you feel like
I okay, so you won't say so.
But I promise we'll take the world to its feet.
You want others to say so.
If that's what they feel from what I can hear, then yeah.
Okay, well, I will say so. I thought that I was reading your... Okay, so one somebody's calling me now trying to help you. Hold on 1 second, Candace, all right?
I'll rise like the day. I'll rise unafraid. I'll rise up. And I do it 1,000 times again. You.
Okay, Candace, I'm back now. So
right.
I just feel a little discombobulated, but I feel powerful. I shouldn't say that about myself, but I do. I think about that I could lose my power when I start feeling like I'm messing up, and I don't. It's okay that I mess up from time to time, as long as I recover, and I do recover. So I hope everybody can hear you, and. I just wanted to say this, too. I was looking at your website and whatever was on the internet as much as I could read last night, and it's quite a bit of showing your artwork. You have quite an extensive art piece of or collection of, what? How do you refer to it as? Series.
Well, I generally work in series of work.
Right.
So I create... individual body of work, and some that are most important to me is the work that you saw the other night, Hooded Truth. Another series that is extremely important to me is a series called Dust in Their Veins, Women and Water Rights,
mm-hmm.
and it speaks to the issue of the scarcity of water, clean water on this planet, and who that affects the most. And the people who are most affected by the lack of clean water are undeniably women and children. And then in that group, undeniably women and children, they're undeniably women and children of melanin. So whether they're living in sub-Saharan Africa, Central America, or India, they are the people with melanin who suffer from a lack of clean water. So that's an issue that is dear to my heart, and I explore those issues through my art. So the show that you saw, Hooded Truth, is important to me. The water issue is important to me. And finding solace in one's own life is important to me. So I also have another very large series that was called Prayer Circles, Sacred Text and Abstract Thought. And it was a show that traveled for 3 years and showed in houses of worship or sacred spaces three times each of the 3 years. because we know that 3 is a divine number. So those are the big projects that I've done in my life as an artist.
And that one you were speaking of, covered 3 years, correct?
Yes.
And that was with people from all walks of religious or spiritual interests?
Yes.
As well as agnostics? And what did you, and what did you do? What actually happened?
Oh, there's nothing that happened.
Oh, okay.
It's the art that I created. And I was hoping that this particular art would be a bridge for two very different kinds of groups of people. One group being those people who rarely go into a house of prayer.
Okay.
And those people who rarely go into a museum. And it was my deepest interest to see those two different kinds of people standing next to one another, looking at the same art.
Okay.
And what would be their takeaway.
Okay.
From that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So my art lovers had to come into churches to see the work.
Okay.
And of course, some of my art lovers are church-going people, but there's some people who rarely go into churches.
Okay. Okay.
And then there's some church folk who probably have never been in a museum.
Mm-hmm.
Do the gallery scene. And so I brought art into their home, into
okay.
their place that they feel most comfortable, outside of their personal home, of course, and watched a change happen between these different people. And it was really quite wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
These two different groups of people looking at the same work. And feeling something from it.
Mm-hmm. So I wasn't quite clear about what was the prayer series, how you engaged people. So you have this art, but you put it in various places so that people are looking at the art, but they're part of the performance. They're part of the piece, the series. They're being there.
Yeah, I guess they are part of the... They do become part of the piece, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, powerful, wonderful. It says, I was reading too, it said that you didn't declare yourself a professional artist until 2007, because up until then, but you had been doing art for always.
Yeah, I often think that people have an impulse or a compulsion to do certain things. The little child who tinkers with the clock and the toaster and everything else in their mother's house and their father's garage, that they go, oh, stop. And there's a compulsion to find out how that works there. You know, so children, I think, always intuitively know who they are. Those things are sometimes taken away from them through a lack of education or a lack of tolerance or a lack of understanding or out of a fear. So sometimes those things are taken away from children. I always drew. I had this one drawing on a wall in my mother's house that she never knew until the first time she had the house repainted. And the gentleman moved something out of the way to get to the wall, and he said, oh, do you want me to cover this over? And my mother saw this drawing I had done on the wall. And she was just like, oh, my, could you paint around that? And she saved it, which was so very sweet of her. So I always drew pictures. But I always did more than that. I was the kind of kid who arranged plays. I wrote my first play. I think I was in second grade. And it was a nativity play. I remember very well. I cast it from the children in the neighborhood. I took sheets from my mother, and I made the costumes. I hand-drew tickets and sold them in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I put popcorn and put them in little brown bags and sold the food for the entertainment for the play. And I put on a play, and I think I was in second grade.
Hmm.
So I've always done things, you know, and it's who I was. It's who I am.
Mm-hmm. You said that you traveled extensively in, what is it, Africa, Northern Africa?
Oh, I wish I had traveled extensively in North Africa.
Or what about, was it Europe?
My mother was a gal who, she was a school teacher. She taught for nearly 40 years in the Chicago public school system. And during the summers, those were those miracle times where it was vacation for 3 months for everyone in the family. And so we got in the car, we traveled, we got on planes, we traveled. I think that we saw most of the continental U.S. before I turned 10. I don't think we went to North Dakota. I'm not sure that we went to Wyoming, but every other state we got to before I was 10. At the age of 8, my mother decided that her children should see Europe. And so she arranged a grand tour of Europe for her 4 children. And we drove to D.C., where my uncle was, and then he drove us to New York, where we caught a flight from what was Idlewild Airport then, which is now Kennedy, and we flew from Idlewild into Amsterdam, from Amsterdam to London, which was our first stop, and we toured all over Europe that summer.
Okay.
So I'm very blessed with the mother and father that I had. Daddy, because he allowed us to do it, because he stayed home and worked. And mother, because she had that vision that she wanted her children to see and know the world and know that we were world citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So as a little kid, I had that knowledge given to me that this whole place is mine.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't just my neighborhood or my city or my state or my country. It was my world.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So we were blessed kids. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a good time.
Mm-hmm. Candace, I have someone. There's someone in here that might be able to help me figure out how come I'm not able to get you on the phone line. But if you just be patient with me once more. Would you please try that number again, 359-5483? Thank you. 217-359-5483. Thanks. Bye-bye. All right. Okay, let's see what's happening here. Okay, so now this is here, right?
Yeah.
And that's it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Send a mark on. What do I do? Touch this here. Hello?
Hello, good morning.
I don't hear anything.
Hello?
Do you hear anything?
Eunice?
You're on air with Weft.
Hello, good morning.
Hello?
There's nothing. And
where's your headphones at? Wait a minute. The system. Hello?
Hello, good morning.
Oh, wow. There we go.
God.
Okay, we got you fixed.
That thing on the side, huh?
Yes, it was turned all the way down.
Dang. I'm so sorry. No, I'm not. I'm not sorry. I apologize. Not I'm sorry. Okay, Candace, this is great. Renee Angela helped me and helped us to do this redder. Right on. Okay, Candace?
Yes, good morning.
You can hear me good, okay?
I can hear you. It's not as clear as when you were on your own phone, but I can hear you.
Oh, it's not as clear?
No.
Okay, so let's get clear here. How can we get clear, Renee? What do I need to do to be clearer? She says it's not as clear.
Well, that's probably because of the microphones.
Oh, the microphone, should I have it further away? Or because I want her to hear me okay.
Let's see if we... Okay.
How about that, Candace?
Oh, that's lovely.
Oh, my goodness. She knows. She knows. This is so funny. Okay, girl. All right. So you had a wonderful experience, so that global view you have about who you are, this world citizen, that is how you present yourself when I met you. You are a citizen of the world. And,
absolutely.
Yes. This particular piece, though, this series, The Hooded Truth, I know based on what's been going on in the news, what provoked you to create some art surrounding that. But what you shared with us at your reception on Thursday was a historical insight into why this was important that you speak to this particular thing. So what was the coming together of everything? Historically, you talked about our history as slaves in this country, the civil rights, all of that. What brought it all together and you said, I'm going to do this piece for you?
The death of Trayvon Martin, the very unjust death of a black boy. Kids shouldn't be murdered. He was a kid. He was just a kid. I've got a 16-year-old right now, and she's taller than I am, and some people might look at her and they go, oh, she's in college now, or she's out of college. Or I'm just like, no, she's a kid. She's a girl. He was a boy. He was some mother's son. He was some father's son. He had dates he hadn't had yet. He had proms he hadn't gone to yet. He had the follies that he hadn't been able to commit yet, because all kids should have follies so they can figure out what's right, what's wrong, and how to move forward into being an adult. He was not allowed those choices. All of those choices were taken away from him and were taken away from his parents. And that death so disturbed me. And In the talk, I talked about Emmett Till. I have a very dear friend who's a playwright. Her name is Eva Baeza, and she wrote a play called The Ballad of Emmett Till that had come out. It had been performed for the first time 2 years prior to Trayvon's death. And when she was readying for that play, she was doing a lot of travel back and forth to Mississippi and other places to do her research. And I was fortunate enough to tag along for a couple of the trips and meet some of the people and be there for her research. So even though Emmett was murdered right before I was born, I knew the name, I knew the story, but from a very, a couple blocks away kind of way. And working with my friend and watching her and listening to the research and listening to the play, the entire history of Emmett Till became very fresh for me. So he was still very fresh in my mind when Trayvon was murdered. And I saw the parallels of these two young men. Emmett was a much more horrific death, absolutely. There was torture involved. There was an ugliness. There was a complicity of an entire community. But the thing that was the same between these two black boys was that the nation took notice.
Mm-hmm.
The nation looked at this And I always have to, at this point, applaud Emmett Till's mother, the late Mamie Till Mobley, because she was the one who said, no, someone's going to see mm-hmm. what they did to my boy.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't let that go. She said, someone is going to see what they did to my boy. And so when he was brought back to Chicago for his funeral, she made the funeral directors leave the casket open mm-hmm. so that the world could see how her beautiful boy had been violated.
Mm.
And it was those images that the Chicago Defender published and Jet Magazine published that took the world by storm, and people were really, I don't even have the right words for it, but people took notice, and people said, this is wrong. And so not since the death of Emmett has the nation looked at the death of a black boy and deemed this black boy's death important to report on, important to feel about, important to do something about.
Mm.
And so I am an artist. And as an artist, what is it that I can do when things are important? I create work around it. And so I started looking around, and there was a lot of work being done very quickly by other artists that had Trayvon in his hood, and the image became iconic almost immediately, almost overnight. And I decided I wanted to do something with this hood as well, but I didn't want Trayvon's face in the hood, because Trayvon at that point was standing as an image for the death of multitudes of black children.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought about it further that, you know, if you remove the face from the hood becomes like a loop. It becomes a lens. And so I decided to look at not just his death, not just Emmett's death, but the death of a lot of people who are people of melanin, who are the children of abducted Africans, of enslaved Africans, and to look at those unjust deaths, because the injustice started a very long time ago. It did not start with Emmett. It didn't end with Trayvon. It started the moment one man and one woman was stolen from the continent of Africa and traveled across the water and brought to the New World, whether they were in the Caribbean, whether they were in South America, whether they were in North America. These people's lives were taken, were stolen from them. Their families were left thousands of miles away, not knowing what happened to their children. And they were presented with a new reality that was very harsh and very ugly. And yet, somehow, we continue to survive, because I am a part of that we. I'm a part of that bloody legacy, that horrific legacy. And somehow my ancestors decided life was more important than anything, and to create life was more important than anything, and that we were going to survive. And we have, even though there are entities that still try to take our lives away, but we still survive. And that is the miracle and the joy of blackness. And I think people, sometimes my own, forget that joy, that we are the ultimate survivor. We really, really are. So no matter what has come in our direction, we survive. And I think sometimes maybe that's the pain to other people who would want to do us ill, that they know we keep on surviving.
Or we're reminders of something that, like you said, they didn't look at what's happening then and see how inhumane it was. Even when we thought about the lynchings, you have also a series that includes, with this Hood of Truth, correct?
Yes.
Of lynchings, to symbolic of lynchings in trees and how they would burn the bodies. You spoke about that at the reception also. And they had postcards of people standing around looking at these bodies and people having picnics, and their children were there watching these bodies hanging from the trees. So this, we're reminders of how violent and hateful we have been in this country, has been. And so I think, too, it's not just survival. Yes, I think we didn't make ourselves get here. You can't destroy life, but you can try to eliminate. But that, I think we're reminders. I think that's what my husband said. We're reminders of what was done. And so when you bring these, not only do you have this art, but you speak to that, to the prison system, and you have artwork that shows how the incarceration and the inhumanity of incarceration and how many people of color are in prisons and how inhumane it is to have prisons. I think you spoke about one from New Hampshire where there's one person on death row. And
none of my art speaks to prison populations per se, because mm-hmm. I am not that authority. I can't talk to those kinds of numbers. But that, those are some algorithms that are so deep that it really takes some serious social scientists to address men, women, children who are imprisoned in this country. The pieces that I have are specifically about men on death row
mm-hmm.
In the United States of America, and not just being on death row, but the disparity mm-hmm. of the numbers of black men on death row versus the entire numbers of people on death row.
Mm-hmm.
And so the images that I have, I originally did five of them, and the five pieces, I had New Hampshire, Texas, Louisiana, California, Mississippi. Did I miss one? Was that five? I don't know if I called out five. Forgive me. And I was looking at the numbers. Now, the numbers that I took, because the series is 2 years old now, and so the numbers that I used were from 2012. So the numbers that you see on the wall are going to be different today.
Okay.
But I don't think the numbers look like a fraction. So it's 242 over 766. And so that would represent 242 black men out of 766 men on death row. And that might be in a state where the black people are less than 8% of the population. So how is that mathematically possible?
Mm-hmm.
How is that possible? And so it's just how black boys are seen as men too soon by eyes that look at them, how they're deemed to be adults before they can be adults, how they're seen as threats, how they're seen, and it's being brought up back into this election year, the super predators, how they're seen as such so early. And so then it's no wonder that they are arrested easier jurors are longer, deeper, stronger. The juries that see them as vile when they may not see another person as vile. And so the imbalance goes on and on and on. This week I was reminded, and I know the world is not this dividing line between black and white, and that's not ever what I'm saying or imagining, because I know it's not. But there are entities on one side of the fence that would do things to continue a legacy of pain and hurt. And so this last couple of weeks I've been reminded of this. There have been three young men in the news recently who have all done vile, forceful, and unimaginable things to women on their campuses. They have raped unconscious women on their campuses. One gentleman just last week, and I'm just using gentleman as a lightweight term, not as reality. The judge said he didn't want this to deter this young man's future. And so he was giving him a parole. He was not going to get assigned the sexual offender. He was not going to be on that list. So he, after college, he can go and get jobs, and he can go on to a life. And so there have been three incidences like that very, very recently of teenage white fellows who have done horrible things to women who will remember forever. You know, to the day they die, they will remember this. It will affect their lives forever. And yet these three different judges in three different states have decided that these young men's futures are more important than the sin and the crime they committed at 18 and 19. And so they're basically letting them off scot-free. A young black boy in a park playing by himself with a toy gun is seen by a similar set of eyes as somebody with no future, and so it's okay to take their life. And so there's this huge disparity on how black boys are seen in this world by the judicial system, by the policing system, sometimes by their teachers, as opposed to the future for a white boy. And it's just, the disparity is so alarming to me, and I'm not sure how all eyes don't see this. I don't understand that. I don't understand how any judge could sit there and say what these three judges have said recently, that, you know, any man who rapes a woman should be thrown in prison. I'm sorry. I'm just sorry. If you rape a woman, you should be in prison. You've affected a woman's life forever. It's not, it wasn't in the moment. It's her life forever. She will forever be that person. I don't care what kind of counseling she gets. There are certain things that change you. And they forever took something away from a woman.
Well, that's interesting.
And to say that their future might be damaged because of this one act of frivolity, this one act of, oh, devil may care, is crazy.
Let me do an announcement and make sure everybody knows whom I'm speaking with on the radio. This is Higher Ground, WEFT, Champaign 90.1 FM, and I'm talking with Candace Hunter, artist. And she has a art showing that will extend through October 7th, 2016, this year, that began on Thursday this week, called The Hooded Truths. And it's very provocative and interesting. So please go to the YMCA on campus at 1001 South Wright Street. Okay, Candace, you talked about that. Also, this is what happened to women, too, who were taken from Africa. This raping, and also the raping of women who were in slavery. There's this.
No, absolutely.
So how, do we recover?
This is probably probably one of the ugliest truths for me, is that on long voyages between the shores of Africa, the western shores of Africa, to the New World, entertainment was necessary. Entertainment was often a black woman. There is documentation of slave ships that had holes cut in the floor where there would be easy access to bring a woman up on deck, to violate her, to have her be the sexual entertainment for any number of the crew. So before some enslaved women ever set foot in the New World, they had already been violated beyond belief. I always tell people to look around at the entirety of a black community. So I'm a woman, I'm a black woman who doesn't have a great amount of melanin. I'm fair skinned. My dad was fair skinned. My mother was fair skinned. His father was fair skinned. His mother was fair skinned. You look around our black communities and we come in a multitude of colors. From the prettiest, darkest, cherry chocolate of color to something that, you know, looks like the inside of a peach, to something that's barely any color at all. And trust me, all of those changes didn't come through the last generation of people of where it's become acceptable for interracial marriages. It has been going, we've been looking a whole lot of different ways for a very long time. And the reason we look a lot of different ways is because black women were raped. There's no easy way to say it. Black women were raped over and over and over again. They continually gave the master on the plantation, the someone else, his brother, his uncle, his daddy, the ability to impregnate an enslaved African woman. And so her children started looking different from her. And so what we have now is a race of African Americans who look like all of the seed that made us. All of the seed that made us. And so we have to understand that it was because of race. I've had some younger people talking about, well, there was love. I'm like, no, when you are owned by somebody, there can be no love, because love is freedom. And so if you're owned by someone and you don't have your own freedom, you cannot be in love. You cannot. There was no love if someone owned you and took you. Just cannot be. And so we look like we look because of rape.
I was reading Beloved, and there was also in the book Beloved by Toni Morrison, there was also this kind of abuse of African males, too, within the institution of slavery.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all of slavery was abuse.
And in terms of the sexual abuse, and also the what you were talking about in terms of the entertainment or ways in which they probably entertain themselves by using this sexual kind of violence with men too. And it's really painful to think that, okay, once you experience this, this is forever, what, part of your legacy? And is this why we are survivors? We see ourselves as surviving this kind of legacy, or there's a...
So I don't see... That word for me is troublesome.
Which one is that?
When you talk about violence and abuse and
yes.
legacy.
Yes.
Legacy, to me, signals I'm an heir to something great.
Yes.
Abuse is not something great.
No.
Violence is not something great.
No.
So that is what I've come through, but that's not my legacy. My legacy is that I've come through it, that I had people who continue to laugh, who were my grandparents, my great-grandparents, my great-grandparents. I had people who had strong backs.
Mm-hmm.
That's my legacy. I had people who were the original artisans and iron workers and planters and rice workers and cowboys of this nation. That's my legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Not that somebody tried to take those things away from me.
Right,
that's
right.
That's not my legacy.
Right.
Abuse is not my legacy.
So do
and
you
I
think...
I will claim that.
Okay, and I agree with you. But do you think, this is my question here, is that what we are thinking as our legacy? It's one thing to say, yes, we've come through that and we laughed and we continue to do our work and to thrive and to do well. But do we see this as a legacy? Do we misconstrue in our own thinking that this experience is something that I inherited, is a thread that is with me forever, and how do I not look at that? Not necessarily don't do anything with it, but is that something we are paying too much attention to in terms of, do we look at it as a legacy, something
well,
that we inherited, something we can't get around?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Because first of all, I don't believe in the empirical we.
Okay.
There are too many of us with too many different mamas who taught us too many different things. We've all had too many different teachers. We've all had too many educational experiences to use that empirical we and say that we, you know, I don't believe in that word.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that as a group of people, horrible things have been done to us as a group.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible things continue to be done to us as a group, and that we probably all need to be in intensive therapy. You know, I remember the first time that one of these horrific shootings had happened in a school, and the news reported that counselors were being brought in.
Mm-hmm.
And that families could also speak. And, you know, and there was this immediate response that you needed to be able to talk about what happened to you. And as a group of people, we've not had that ability to talk to somebody about what has happened to us. And I used to date a psychologist, and he said, all black people need therapy. And when he first said it, I went, what? And he says, no, not like we crazy, but that we need to talk about the things that we've seen, that we felt, that have come to us, that have been passed on to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because we understand, because it's been very well documented by Holocaust survivors, that there are generational things that have happened since the Holocaust. So the children of Holocaust survivors tend to be very quiet, people who, because they walked on eggshells around their parents who were still living in so much pain and could not talk about it. And then the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors are angry at what happened, and they can look at it from a certain distance and affect change because there's a distance now. And so there's another kind of generational thing. So there are generational things that happened with us as well, and there was never anybody to write it down, to talk about it, or to get help.
Yes, it's interesting,
and
too.
As a people, we generally, and I don't like the generalization, but generally, up until probably this last generation, have not thought out any kind of therapy. We've eschewed the talking about stuff. We've like, no, keep that in the house. No, we don't talk about that to somebody. Or the most that we do is we speak to a minister.
Mm.
Your girlfriend or minister. You know, so
mm-hmm.
we have, as a larger group of people, we've not thought out ways in which to talk about these injustices.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess, in a way, my creating this work is part of my therapy. That's a way for me to talk about the injustices.
Mm-hmm. And that comes through.
Maybe people who view it get to do a little of the same thing that I felt in creating the work.
Mm-hmm. You were speaking to also a work of art that Jason, an artist, did that was, you were responding to a question that was posed to you at the reception by this man who said that your art series is very one-sided. And he says, do you look at the other side of the picture? The victim, what about punishment for people who commit violent crimes? Are you looking at the other side? And your answer to that was, I thought, very good for me, for everybody listening. But you also talked about this piece of art where it depicted the amount of time in which slavery occurred, post-slavery, civil rights, Jim Crow, all of that, and then where we are now. Do you remember that?
Right.
Yes.
Jason Patterson, an artist in Champaign, is a wonderful artist who I was fortunate to meet, I guess, about 2 years ago. And we've since become very friendly colleagues. We don't see each other enough to say that we're really friends, but I would like to think that we are. I came down to Champaign, I think around this time last year. He had a show of his work, and there was a talk with Brian Dolinar, who's also there at the university, who had written a book on the WPA writers of Illinois. And so I was very excited to come down and see his book and to see Jason's new work. So the work I'd seen previously of Jason were based, he's very concerned with history. And I love how his mind works and how he looks at history and how he deals with history. And so he does these beautiful portraits of people who've done something. And so that's what I was expecting to see. Except I got down there, and there were four panels, canvas panels, rectangles, hung horizontally. I think there were four. And each one was a different color, a solid color. And I thought, well, this isn't Jason's work, this highly conceptual work, until I went and I read the placards. And then I said, this is so Jason's work, because he was creating a visual bar graph on what has been the lives of the African-American community in America since slavery. And so the largest painted bar was the years of slavery. And then the second largest bar were the years of Jim Crow. And then the next set was the Civil Rights Movement. And then the next bar, I think, was the now. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at the different sizes of these bars, and you could just very quickly visually go, oh, this modern life I'm in right now is but a second compared to all of the pain that went before, all of the injustice that went before, all of the denial of rights that went before, all of the denial of humanity that went before.
Mm-hmm.
What we're living in right now is just a second.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such a clear statement that he made with this work.
And so I can...
I was so moved by it. And so
we're talking about it. We're talking about that one piece right there when I think about being in therapy, that the nation is in therapy, needs to be in therapy. These institutions and these systems need to be in therapy. You're saying we need to talk about it, and it's not just the people who experienced it, but the ones who benefited from it. Those people who are silent that this is actually has actually occurred. And there's no apology. There's no restitution. There's nothing much in terms of being in therapy. I'm a therapist myself. And one of the things that I have encountered of late is also experience with people who have sought therapy because, yes, they have their general anxieties about life or school or work or just being. But in addition to being a person of color, there's been so much in the media about the killings and the police and the protesting and the violence against the protesters, et cetera, that people are experiencing a different type of anxiety now. And I got a phone call the other day, and it was from someone seeking therapy for their client. It was a person who was seeing a person, but said the client asked to see someone who is African American because they did not think that this person could relate. But not only was this person saying they weren't, she thought they weren't able to relate to her, but she said that she had gone as far as she could go, and that she needed more cognitive behavioral therapies, more DBT therapy. And my thought was, you need therapy. I didn't say that to her, but the fact that we continue to say, you know, you need some cognitive behavioral therapy. Now that's cognition is thinking and behavior and, you know, technique or training or thinking differently. But everybody thinks and everybody behaves. So are you saying that we need to, not you, Candace, but are you saying we need to learn how to deal with these anxieties, or we need to change, you need to change the way it's been maintained, the way it has consistently been maintained, and even within the therapeutic context. Many African Americans may not want to go into treatment, but not only African Americans, but I'll speak to them, because they don't trust that you're listening. Not, I didn't say this to her, but do we trust that you are going to be understanding and compassionate when you listen and not say, well, I don't know what you've been through. You know what pain feels like. You know what violence feels like. You know what not having access to resources feel like. You know what it feels like to be treated badly. But if it's the color of our skin that says, well, it's a different experience there, you know. So I'm very leery sometimes of this, you know, people saying, oh, you need to be in, you need some CBT. You know, you're not crazy. This is not crazy. This is insanity to try to figure out how am I going to adapt to an insane system that is perpetuated to look like it's normal. The question that that man asked you at the your reception, I thought was, I didn't speak to him. I thought to speak to him about it, but I wonder if he was just asking the question to be provocative. Or was he really interested?
No, I don't think he was asking to be provocative. I think he's living, we talked about a lot of us are living in a place of anxiety right now with all that we're seeing in the news of black boys and black men being shot and killed by the police and protests against the police and Black Lives Matter, and then people saying All Lives Matter, and then other people not involved in either one are going, well, you're crazy. No, you're crazy. And it, and so it's a lot. It's a whole lot. And so if you're looking at it outside of this race, and I'm speaking as you and I speaking of being black women, so someone else is looking at it, and they're looking at one of the young men and, you know, is selling cigarettes, and it's an illegal activity. And this one, you know, was running away from the police. Well, why? And so they're already, the world, television media is conditioning the world to see that black people are criminals. And that's what I'm saying, is that little boys are seeing as men early, that institutions and teachers see them as men when they're still little boys. They see them as teenagers when they're toddlers. They're, from very on, they're always seen as older than they are and treated like they're older than they are, like they should know better when they're just kids, and kids don't know better, you know. And so I think his worldview was telling him that these people are criminals, and as such, should have punishment exacted against them. He was not seeing the entirety of my show. He was reacting to what he's been feeling and seeing in the news in the last year. He was not looking at the entirety of my show. He was zeroing in on one thing that looked and felt like what's going on right now. And my show deals with 2.5 centuries of history. And he was looking at the right now. He was zeroing in on the right now and the criminality of blackness. That's where he was going, and I saw it. And so in a second, I had to figure out, how do I get him to open up his eyes and then his heart just a little bit? I can't get anybody to change their whole worldview in a half an hour talk. But maybe I can get you to see just a little differently in one little area. And so that's why I jumped on his side. And I said, so you're talking about the gentleman on death row in New Hampshire. I said, let's be clear. That gentleman murdered somebody's son. He should be punished. There is no, I have no doubt that the man should be punished. When you take a life, you should be punished. And I looked at him, and I held his eyes as long as I could. And I said, but it's how we punish. Are we going to be a civilized society, or are we going to continue barbarian acts that create more barbarian acts? What are we going to choose to be as a society? And I think because I went to his side and kind of, in my talking to him, walked him from his side to thinking differently about something, that he was better with it. And he did come up and speak to me afterwards, and he said, I think that I always need to do more research before I speak. Mm-mm. Which is a wonderful thing because we all need to learn. Mm-hmm. Each and every day we need to learn.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as a observer myself, this was so common sometimes, and I understand if this person does not speak and ask a question or reveal their thoughts, then you can't have a conversation. And I think it's really important that you have conversations, but you also very directly and poignantly require that that person look at themselves, whether you're saying it that way or not. I think it's so important that we not shy away from the conversation, because this is the kind of conversations we've been having a long time. And that is, we don't want to upset people. We don't want to stir it up. We don't want to look like we're not thankful for where we are or whatever, but don't stir it up. And when I went, when I listened to you, you do look people straight in the eye and you speak to them. And if they want to turn away, that's okay, but you're not. And I appreciate that. And from that, observing you, watching you, and looking at your art and how much your art, your expression is all you. It's all you. On the radio now, everything is all you. That it encourages people who experience being in your presence to be all of themselves. Even if you are a person who, an individual like that man who had to ask the question of you, had to share his opinion, his thoughts about himself, but he was able to do that without thinking, I need to filter what I need to say before I say it. Because evidently, this is what people are thinking. They are thinking that it's okay to do these things. It's okay for these systems to be in place. It's okay. There's something that's wrong with the people who are not quite getting it, but everything else is okay. But it isn't. And so when we can do that, I really appreciate the fact that you do it so well. You draw people out of their comfortable place and you challenge them to look. And I think art should do that. And you do it. And you do it with your spoken word. Your sister said you should do more writing.
She's biased.
She's biased.
She's biased, yeah.
Well, she loves you. Okay, yeah. So let's talk a little bit. I know we talked a lot about what we've talked about. It's been absolutely fabulous. It's wonderful and insightful. But your medium is collages or other things too?
Other things too, but mostly collage work. I use whatever makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not completely wedded to one art form. Probably the reason I do collage more than anything else is a really silly reason. I had met a gallerist in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
who I knew her gallery. I knew her. And I wanted her to represent me. And I had tried several times to get her to come to shows, and I was not successful. And she finally came to a show of mine, and it was literally the day after the show closed. It was the day I was to take the work down. And she met me over there that afternoon and walked through the work and kind of nodded her head a lot. And then she says, okay, I'll come to the studio and see your work. And I had one collage that's here that I did when I was recovering from surgery one time.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're laying in a bed all day, there's not a lot of things you can do.
Mm.
But you can cut paper.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a stack of magazines and you can cut paper. So I had created this collage while I was in recovery. And the collage was based on a memory from undergraduate school. And so she saw this one piece, and it was the only collage that I had. And it was really not a piece that I had ever done to think would go on a show or anything. It was very personal. and it was a healing piece, and, you know, it was healing in terms of my physical body at that moment, but it was also a healing piece in terms of what I was dealing with in undergraduate school. And so she looked at me and she says, oh, my dear, you are a collagist.
Mm. Nicole went, Smith.
A collagist,
mm-hmm.
ISC.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what? She says, if you do collage for me, I'll represent you.
Mm-mm.
I said, I guess I'll be doing collage.
Mm.
And it was purely because I wanted gallery representation.
Gotcha.
And so I started on my first body of collages,
okay,
that dealt with my family and my family's history.
Mm.
I don't even know. I can't even remember the title of the series anymore.
Was Galleryist Nicole Smith?
That was the gallery.
Goyer and Me and Mine. Oh My.
That's not the name of the series.
Okay. Though. All right.
I can't think of it right now.
Okay.
It's early in the morning. I haven't had coffee.
Okay.
But it was based, loosely based on my family story. I'm very lucky that I know my family story back to 1812,
mm-hmm,
on my father's side of the family. So it was loosely based on my family story, but the series was fleshed out by the stories of countless African Americans in this country.
Mm.
So I created this mythical family that went from 1812 to the present. And it was, you know, my family, but it was a lot of family. So there are a lot of stories embedded in collage. And the wonderful thing about collage work is that you can create multiple stories because you've got multiple layers of things. So
mm-hmm,
there can be multiple stories in one piece.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was my family, but it was a lot of Black families.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't us alone. Nobody lives alone.
Is this a correct, direct quote from you? I'm not sure, but the idea of collecting chaos, order, history all appeal to me in very visceral ways, and we and are turned back into these works.
Yes.
Let me see. There's another one. The type of collagist Candace is, she's a practitioner of inclusion and willingly inherits the wealth and the burdens of history.
Okay, I didn't write that.
Mm-hmm.
That is from an article that a writer by the name of Jason Foumberg,
yes,
Foumberg, wrote in a New City article.
Mm-hmm.
He had come for a studio visit. I had a show up, and I guess he couldn't make it to the show, so he said, man, this is a studio, and I did, and he did. And that was something very lovely he said about me, and I used it because people sometimes see what I cannot articulate easily. And by saying that I willingly, read that line again, because I don't
okay.
have it in front of me. You have it.
Yes, I've read a lot. Says Candace is of this type of collages. She is a practitioner of inclusion and willingly inherits the wealth and the burdens of history.
So that's what I love. That's what he saw in what I do, that I probably never could have articulated it that
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true that the wealth and the burden of history,
mm-hmm.
Because it's both things. It was like what I was saying earlier. My legacy is not the pain, but I have to look at the pain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My legacy is the joy
mm-hmm.
and the survival. But I have to look at the pain to see how great that survivorship is.
Mm-hmm. You've also have...
There has to be a balance that you figure out. Wow, my people were really fabulous.
Right.
So they killed this, and this, and they still succeeded. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to look at it like that. Like,
wow.
This was done, and this was done, and they still had me.
Wow. mm-hmm.
this and this and this, mm-hmm. and they still have the temerity to say, I'm going to keep on keeping on.
Wow.
What kind of super creatures are these?
Wow.
Super.
So let me ask you, and I also want to touch upon your adoptive parents, James Bearden. I'm making a little light slight here. James Van Der Zee and Ramon Bearden.
That's my joke.
I know.
That's a joke.
But
For your listening audience who may not know these two names, Romare Bearden is one of the most acclaimed African-American artists of the 20th century. And James Van Der Zee was one of the most acclaimed African-American photographers of the 20th century. James Van Der Zee, in his photographing Harlem, which was his home, he wanted to show black folks in their best light. He had an incredible studio in Harlem, and he dressed folks, he dressed up the photos. His desire, which, you know, he succeeded at, was to show us, to document us in our best light, because he knew other people were documenting us in our darkest moments. And he wanted to have the world see the absolute beauty of who we are as a people. Romare Bearden was a collage artist. He's best known as collage artist, though he worked in many art forms, but he's best known for his collage work. And when I have a quote when I talk about chaos, well, it really stems from a quote that August Wilson wrote about his playwriting that came from the work of Romare Bearden, where he says, from the chaos of many ideas, in the shuffling, you finally come down to the creation of something quite beautiful. So I dare say that people who probably would have gone into Romare's studio when he had multitudinous newspapers and magazines and books strewn about and cutting and tearing, that it looked crazy. And then you'd see this finished piece. So out of all this chaos, out of this upheaval, out of all of these ideas, became this one incredible thought. And so I used to joke that if two men could have had a child,
would be you.
It'd be me.
Because
I'm concerned with the beauty of us and celebrating the beauty of us. And I'm interested in how I take all of these different stories, throw them up in the air, and come out with something else.
I tell you. Let me read you a comment. There's some comments that was made about you, your art series at the Southside Center in Chicago a few years ago. And it says, the sister is back with a vengeance. The woman paints your mind. Candace is doing the damn thing. I like that one. I like that.
That was nice.
Yeah. That's, I tell you, that's what I feel. It's like you are a tall woman.
Oh, I'm not tall. You
to
know.
Me, to me, you look tall.
Okay, this is my family joke. I'm the midget in my family.
Oh, okay, got you.
I'm 5'8", but I'm the shortest in my family. Mm-mm. I come from a family of very tall people.
Okay.
And so I didn't know that I was tall until I went to college.
Okay.
And I met lovely people like yourself who are a little less tall than I am.
But there's a tallness about you, and that's what I said. There's a presence.
I'm not so short after all.
Yes.
So it's all about our perspective.
Exactly. This is what I'm saying. Yes, this is what I felt in your presence, that strength, that tower of strength. that presence. And that encouraged me. You also have a showing, and you probably other ones I didn't see. I know I saw this one in Milwaukee at the Gallery in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
I have a show that I'm very proud of. It is called So Be It, See to It.
Okay.
Visual renderings of the work and words of Octavia E. Butler.
Exactly.
For those who don't know, Octavia Butler is the queen of speculative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
She is the queen of science fiction. She is one of my heroes in the literary world. Unfortunately, we will get no more books out of Miss Butler because she passed 10 years ago, but her work is already monumental.
Yes.
And this year, a lot of entities were celebrating the anniversary of Octavia. And Clock Shop LA out in Los Angeles is doing a year-long set of things, films and artworks and talks about Octavia. The Octavia E. Butler Society down at Spelman College did a program, I think it was in the spring, a conference on Octavia. So there are a lot of entities that were doing things on Octavia. And I had no institutional assistance behind me, but I said, I want to do something about Octavia, too. Why not? And so I had the opportunity. Hello, are we still there?
Yes, we have about a minute left, but yes,
okay,
I'm still here.
Another, a beeping was coming on, and I didn't know what that was. So I think that's an incoming call. I hope your viewers, your listeners are not hearing that. So in less than 5 months, mm-hmm. I created 53 pieces
Mm-mm.
that illustrate the works of Octavia Butler. So it opened a week and a half ago in Milwaukee at the Gallery M, which is in the Intercontinental Hotel. So anybody who's in the Milwaukee area or you're traveling to Milwaukee, please go and see the show. It is so beautiful. It really is. I don't normally like to toot my own horn, but go see the show. It's
okay.
Beautiful.
All right.
And it's up until October the 3rd, I believe. My brain is
September 27th. I think it's at September 27th, but maybe it's extended.
I don't know.
Okay.
But at least a month. It's up for a month.
All right.
Go see it if you're anywhere near.